Off-grid electricity solutions coming into cities? What? Welcome to the Africa Green Collar Project. I am your host, Churchill Omondi Agutu. We're so excited about this month's podcast. Today, we are engaging energy entrepreneur Muresi Ramonyai, where we talk about the future of energy in African cities. We had a chat around off-grid electrification in cities and asked ourselves, why is this strange trend being observed? We talked about business models that are working to off-grid energy solutions. We explored opportunities for mini-grids in Africa. And of course, we had to ask, how can you get involved in this space? So listen in, engage us, and learn something new. Welcome to the Africa Green Collar Project. I am your host, Churchill Omondi Agutu, and today we are talking about the future of energy in African cities. When we talk about urbanization, we mean the increase in population of people living in urban areas. According to an article that was written by Africa in Focus, the population of people living in urban areas is predicted to increase to 1.26 billion by 2050, compared to the 400 million who were there in 2010. Additionally, it said that 60% of the population will reside in informal settlements. So with this high migration, it brings itself challenges. And one of the biggest ones is challenges in infrastructure. Will there actually be enough capacity to be able to handle the increase in population that's moving to urban cities? So to help us with this topic, we're going to talk to Muresi Ramonyai, who is an entrepreneur in energy, and she's going to give us a lot of insight into this. Welcome, Muresi.
Thank you very much.
How about you introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Muresi Ramonyai. I call myself impact entrepreneur, but in general, I am a solar entrepreneur. I have been involved in renewable energy for the last 7 to 8 years, so to speak. I came into the industry as a bidder for the Independent Power Producer Program in South Africa. I developed a 15 megawatt solar PV project. Didn't end up going for it and withdrew for viability reasons, but learned a lot of interesting skills and but also fell in love with the solar PV technology at the same time. So what I did post that is moved a little bit further down the value chain and the pyramid and developed a small EPC called Borena Energy. And at Borena Energy, we develop solar PV technologies and solutions, primarily focusing on the off-grid sector.
Okay. So do you agree with the statement that we made where we talked about the fact that there'll be a high migration of people who are moving into urban areas, and that will mean that there'll be a lot of pressure on the infrastructure that's already existing?
Sure. And I think maybe to bring this into context, I primarily operate in the off-grid sector, like I said. And when you say off-grid, typically what comes to mind is rural communities, is disconnected communities, it's remote, you know, environments. So in essence, anyone who's generally outside of the normal electricity grid. And in this particular case, I have certainly seen that a lot of the solutions and technologies I have provided previously are now being demanded by markets in the city. So it's been a very interesting phenomenon and certainly a big trend. And you are absolutely right, and the article is absolutely right, that migration and urban migration is a big influencer on this. The fact that urban migration happens so rapidly, it's happening at such a pace that the infrastructure is not readily available at times, is not the capacity of the infrastructure is not sufficient, or the capacity of the, you know, of the infrastructure also gets strained, so much so that what you find in cities is that you can often have then sections of the city that have to wait quite a long time to be electrified, or sections of the cities where pressure on the grid is so high that there's, you know, unreliable electricity supply, or certain sections of the city have to be switched off, you know, load shedded, so to speak, to facilitate for sufficient supply. In other circumstances, in other countries, you also get what you call, instead of blackouts, which is what we're used to in South Africa, you get brownouts. Which is, you know, a little bit of that dimming. You know, when your light is not so bright, but it's a little bit orange. Just the amount of electricity coming through is not so much. But certainly, I totally agree, and I can confirm that the demand for off-grid solutions is coming to the city, and it's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, thank you for that. Now that you've given us a little background and some sort of understanding into this migration, mm-hmm. I just wanted to first of all find out, is there a particular section or particular market that's actually that needs access to these off-grid solutions? Are there people living in informal settlements, or does it go as far as the urban areas where you have like skylines and buildings that are commercial buildings that actually need this off-grid solution?
In highest demand, you find that it is the newer and unplanned communities that develop around the cities. So certainly your informal settlements, absolutely, that's where the highest demand is. And in general, then, you know, there's a lot of socioeconomic depression that is also happening in those sectors. In the formal cities and you know, established parts of the city, not so much, except, you know, for you know, people or households or businesses that elect to get off the grid. And a lot of the times the motivation for getting off the grid might be, you know, pursuing a reliability of supply of electricity or something like that. But the majority of the demand for off-grid solutions is often in these very new, unplanned for settlements that crop up. And oftentimes, of course, it's the informal settlements.
Thank you for that. And you are an entrepreneur, which means that you have businesses in the energy space and right. supply and are providing off-grid solutions to a lot of these communities. Right. So that means that you've been able to find a way to make profit or to benefit from mm-hmm. these off-grid solutions. How is what kind of business models have you seen that have actually worked in providing off-grid solutions to those living, say, in informal settlements, which seems to be the bigger market?
So this sort of cuts across different, you know, a whole spectrum, you know, where we're talking from low end type of solutions to higher end solutions, and equally so, you know, the funding thereof would differ between those kinds of solutions. But we're talking at the lowest end of it. We're talking about small solutions like solar lamps. Solar lamps are very useful, they're very practical, they're very much in high demand because, one, they are accessible and they are affordable, and typically solar charge lamps would also double up also as a phone charger. So those are generally sought by individuals because the price point is pretty all right and pretty accessible, but, you know, a lot of it can also get donated and sponsored and whatnot. What you also find is what you call DC lighting, where you have some light fittings that you can put up in your house, you know, about four lights or five lights and whatnot, and they're also solar charged. Those are generally also a little bit affordable, and they can be, available to the individual homeowner, and there's a lot of interest and demand for such solutions. Then you move into a bit of your larger systems, and here then the general market is households that have some sort of income, so they would purchase for themselves a battery storage solar based system, like a 1 kilowatt or a 2 kilowatt system. Here you're talking into the thousands of rands mark, and what is common is that households would then, you know, be able to afford it, provided there's an income in there. But this is also the point where you start seeing the separation and the divide in as far as economic depression. Those that cannot afford anything beyond a lamp or something like that generally cannot, you know, go above and beyond that, and would generally live like one would do in a rural environment. But anyhow, as you go up the, you know, this spectrum, then you start moving into other solutions such as solar street lights. Solar street lights in general, because, you know, street lighting is a community type of service and it's a community benefit. What you find there is in the NGO space or the CSI sort of budgets start coming into play there. So a lot of the demand then comes from corporates who are trying to improve safety or security or access to public lighting and whatnot in those communities. That's where a lot of the demand has come from.
Sorry, what's CSI?
Oh, CSI is a corporate social investment.
Okay.
So, you know, as you are aware, and I'm sure your listeners are also quite aware, but companies, especially big companies in the country and the world over, generally want to be responsible citizens of the communities that, you know, they serve or the communities that, you know, they supply. So a small portion of their funds and their income and their profits get dedicated to doing good in society. So in this particular case, I have a lot of companies that come to me and say, listen, we've identified that this particular community is disconnected from the grid or is not on the grid, and there's issues of crime or there's issues of poor lighting or whatnot. Can we sponsor some, you know, street lights for them or something like that? Or even just general lighting for kids to play at night or things like that. So it's that's the kind of customer we start seeing, because those are a little bit more high valued, you know, technological products. And then of course at a much higher end is what you call just off-grid solar systems, but large scale ones. This is where you're seeing an entire huge building or a school or a church or a large facility that gets powered by renewable energy, and it has backup storage as well so that it can continue to provide electricity beyond the dark. But these really are a lot of the times also funded by donors and international NGOs and things like that, where, you know, it's for the benefit of that society. At the other end of that, I think beyond that, is then what you call mini grids and micro grids, and those are again you know, solar and electricity generating facilities, but they are connected to homes individually, very much like what a normal national grid would look like. So that's the general spectrum, from a simple solar lamp to a home solar system, simple solar lamp to a lighting system, to a little home solar system, to street lighting, to a single-use, commercial-size solar system with backup, all the way up to a mini-grid. And those are the types of solutions you find.
Okay, and do you work through the whole spectrum, or do you focus on specific ones?
I generally work through the whole spectrum. What I haven't delivered so far is the mini-grid.
Okay, and what are some of the biggest challenges that you've faced, considering that you've basically worked through the whole range?
So there's obviously challenges across the board. You are generally working in environments that are economically depressed, like I said. You often work in environments where there's a whole lot of social ills as well and challenges. And for example, the mini grid, I am developing a project, a mini grid project, but it comes with heavy challenges, because what you then require is the ability to pay. That's a concept that is quite strong in this space. Willingness to pay and ability to pay. I think willingness to pay is quite strong, but ability to pay is the big challenge here, because if the community is generally unemployed and, you know, economically depressed, then it's a bit difficult to actually consume that energy in a way that's going to make the investment into that mini grid viable commercially. So that is one of the biggest challenges. And as a result, what I have found more than anything is that a lot of the kind of funding and investment that can go into such projects, especially the ones that I've worked with, is that it's often then donor kind of funding, or it's a CSI kind of funding. Whereas in other circumstances, you would expect to be able to go in there, take some risk, fair enough, but have a model that can actually be sustainable without the need for grant funding or donor funding or anything like that. And of course, the big inhibitor to being able to find commercially viable projects is precisely that the user who ultimately would need to pay for the electricity is often not in a position to do that.
So when you talk about, because it seems like you said, donor funding is one of the biggest enablers for the implementation of these
Absolutely.
Systems. So once, let's say, you do get funding from a donor to implement the system, mm-hmm. is it an investment with almost like a subsidized solution, as it, because you said like you go into a community and mm-hmm. sometimes it's there are chances that the community may not be able to pay for the solution, mm-hmm. but from a social perspective, I mean, you're bringing electricity to a community, mm-hmm. but so is it brought with the expectation that let's say this is going to be the price that the customer will pay and then we'll subsidize it to this amount, or is it more of just we'll implement it and based on our returns we can then continue, say, growing the project, or it can be used for maintenance?
So in general, they're fully funded donations, let me call it that. It's not a part contribution by the donor and a part contribution by the community. That's not always the case. That hasn't been quite a trend. Certainly, I have identified that in as far as making, you know, things like mini grids and whatnot viable, that might very well be the option to go for, or what will make the case bankable, because obviously whatever shortfall in the ability to pay by individual homes, perhaps the donor could back that up. But that's a financial model and a different financial opportunity for the future, you know. I think it per my own, you know, when I look into what the opportunities are. But in general, these are fully funded. Mm-hmm. It's not a subsidy at all. The other thing is that it would be difficult sometimes to enforce these as a subsidy and whatnot, because a lot of these investments are communally beneficial. You know what I mean? It's hence I think that would work in a mini grid, micro grid type of scenario, because each individual home is connected, and there's probably a better way to measure and manage and see what have you as an individual benefited, and this is what the subsidy means, or what the subsidy accrues to in relation to what you need to contribute. But when you are putting together street lighting, for example, for the whole community, it would be quite difficult to actually determine how the community gets to contribute. And I think those are some of the things that lead to, you know, just simply going for a solution where it's a fully funded 100% donor contribution, and that's it.
Okay, just a bit more clarity. Mm-hmm. Does it mean that at this point in time, there's a big drive towards making mini grids a viable solution? Because it seems like it's more like there's development. It's not really almost a for-profit solution. It's like, let's provide this mini grid solution and let's try and empower the people around and try to continue making the solution maybe drive down the price.
Look, mini grids are by far the most interesting development and trend we're going to see going into the future. By far, the future of electrification in Africa is going to be driven by mini grids, simply because that's decentralized energy and it makes absolute sense. It's cheaper than centralized energy. I think the days of building large grids and whatnot is over. And the case for making mini grids profitable and viable is still out there. There's a lot of development, there's a lot of innovation. The cost of renewable energy is going down tremendously all the time. However, obviously with mini grids and that type of thing, you need a lot of backup. So storage is still what drives these costs so high. But the bigger issue that makes these so unviable is that in general, households consume energy at night, not so much in the day. So there's a need for making sure that there's a mix of consumption. So you need a bit of, you know, commercial, you know, anchors as well, and, you know, a filling station, a school or a business and whatnot to take part. There's a whole host of issues and that at play, but certainly there is a big drive and a big effort going into seeing what would make mini grids successful. It's happening quite a lot in East Africa, certainly. I think West Africa, it follows pretty fast behind East Africa in as far as rolling out these mini grids. Southern Africa, not as rapidly, particularly South Africa, because South Africa, I guess, is highly electrified anyway, more than anything. But that is, I would actually recommend that you do a podcast specifically on mini grids, because it's an entire universe, and the future of Africa and its electrification definitely rests in that.
That's a really powerful statement that you've made. I also wanted to ask, so When you talk about these mini-grid solutions, I'm sure there's, and you say that storage is one of is almost like a challenge.
Absolutely.
I've had conversations, and there's a lot of conversations going on now around the idea of smart grids mm-hmm. that could actually be able to facilitate, say, better energy management. Mm-hmm. Is that a conversation that you've heard around the mini-grid space? Has it started? Is it going on, especially in the context of Africa? What are your insights or your perspectives from this?
So smart grids, absolutely. That's definitely one of the areas that's going to improve the effectiveness and the efficiency of delivery of energy in a decentralized context. There's also a lot of talk around peer-to-peer type of energy trading and so forth, where you want to make full use of the energy that's in supply, such that if you're not using yours, let me use it, and if I'm not using it, let my neighbor use it, and that way you manage your energy supply so efficiently that there isn't wastage. So certainly smart grids are a big topic in as far as a value add, and also just an optimization of what these mini grids and these decentralized energy systems are going to look like. A big driver, of course, for that, or a big, a catalyst for that is technology. It will take a lot of technology and investment in tech to make this work. And that's, I guess, where the smart really also is featuring. So certainly a big driver, certainly a big influence, and I think you're going to see that as one of the ways to make these mini grids viable is by actually making sure that you manage the load and the consumption thereof as efficiently as possible.
Okay, and there's something that you've mentioned there that's also very interesting. The idea that technology will become the driver for, say, the implementation of smart grids. Now, if you look at it from a regulation and a policy side, are there any factors that you've seen from like your own experience that have maybe hindered the progress, say, of mini grids? Say, have you seen like, say, municipalities or different regulations that have been put in place that have almost acted as a barrier or an enabler to be able to implement a mini grid solution, or is it almost non-existent?
So, in the case of South Africa, for example, the generation and supply of electricity is monopolized by is a regulated monopoly by the state, and as such, for you to supply any electricity, particularly in the style of a mini grid and in the size of generation that you will be, you do require to be licensed. Licensing obviously requires some cost and investment, so naturally that is one of the inhibitors. But it's not an insurmountable challenge. You can apply for a license, and you can be awarded the license to be an independent power producer. However, if you're going to be operating with in a locality or a municipality who in essence have the right, so to speak, to supply electricity in that space, again, that's a bit of a friction point with that municipality. I do think, however, it's not without opportunity. It's not without opportunity that could be explored, but one of the things that does make it difficult to enter into a locality and take away that from the municipality is that what you are also taking away is a revenue opportunity for that municipality. Our municipalities depend heavily on revenues collected for electricity supply, water supply, and all kinds of services to actually pay for, the wage bills, to pay for their own upkeep and they fund also their own programs. So when I say it doesn't go without the opportunity, what I mean there is that if you were to develop a mini grid and it's within a jurisdiction of another entity, such a municipality, I think one must just look at structuring it in such a way that the income is not completely lost from the municipality, but maybe you improve on the delivery of this service, maybe improve on reducing the costs, but perhaps give the municipality a piece of the profits or something like that. I think it just needs a bit of exploring collaborative opportunities as opposed to wanting to actually alienate completely that section of the society from the municipality, because it does impact their bottom line quite heavily.
Okay, and in line with the idea of opportunity, with the Africa Green Colour Project, we're always trying to get more youth involved in sustainable energy, in food and water, but in this case, it's specifically the topic of energy.
Right.
What do you think are some of the opportunities and some of the ways that youth can become involved from, based on the topic that we're talking about today and your own experience?
Okay, so, I mean, remember I mentioned, in as far as solar PV, which is where I am, I mentioned all the various types of technologies, right from the small handheld solar lamp right through to a large-scale solar, you know, mini-grid installation. But some of the opportunities, I think, for youth, and not just for youth, for anybody, but it's to look into offering some technological solutions in general, the supply of these solutions that I'm talking about. There's always a need for supplying solar lamps or solar radios or solar fans or solar TVs, or there's a whole host of DC products that can be supplied. And these are easy to install because, you know, they pretty much work directly from the sun. So there's a definite opportunity there of being just a hardware supplier of product. The other thing that I think one needs to consider, or the other opportunity, is that, you know, instead of pushing to supply energy in the form of electricity, which is, I guess, the standard obvious way of going about it, I found that there's a big opportunity and even a trend, but that just needs to be elevated. But there's a big opportunity to actually supply energy services. So for me, in fact, I think for me, that's the biggest opportunity so far. You know, and it's to move away from wanting to give electricity, but provide what people will do with that electricity. On a very low level, on a very simple scale, what you find sometimes in cities is that there are stations where you can go and charge your phone, for example. Now, that's an energy service, because, you know, by energy service, what I mean is the things that you will use electricity for. What do we use it for? We use it to charge our phones, we use it for lighting, we use it to wash our clothes, we use it to cook our food, we use it to refrigerate our food, and all sorts of things. So there's an opportunity to actually take those services and take those to market. So offer people phone charging, offer people refrigeration. It can be central, you know. If communities don't mind, I mean, I know sometimes these are psychological barriers. People might not be keen to share a refrigerator with their neighborhood, but in some communities, maybe that can work. But, you know, central refrigeration services, that's an example of an energy service that could be offered. You could offer, renewable energy powered cinemas, you know. So whatever the service, the energy service or the energy application that people use electricity for, in the case where it's perhaps difficult or expensive to provide each and every single person, I think the opportunity is to go out and provide them as a service, so that people only pay for access and don't need to pay for ownership. So certainly that's a beautiful one, I think, for the youth and for anyone who's wanting to enter into that space. There's definitely an opportunity there for you know, creative or alternative financing. People generally, you know, they might not have the lump sum and high capital amount to pay for, you know, a system upfront, a home system, but, you know, we all know that people do have smaller amounts that they would pay for over time. So, you know, for those that are financially astute and are willing to take the risk, I think that's definitely another market to offer financing in the form of loans, in the form of hire purchase, in the form of leasing, or any form that gives people access to these energy hardwares with a bit of a longer term payment you know, method. I think there's definitely other opportunities on the tech side for you know, peer to peer, like I said, you know, creating systems that can allow people to share. This is more sort of on also in sharing economy sort of styled solutions. It lends itself a little bit to what I was saying earlier with the energy services. I mean, I think we should allow people to share, you know, renewable energy hardware so that they can, you know, when one is using it, the other one can maybe not, and then and vice versa. But I mean, why can't people, you know, have a communal, you know, laundry service that's powered by renewable energy instead of everybody trying to get a system that will power up their own, you know, machine, things like that. I think in general, you know, the energy space is has a whole value chain. We have what we call EPCs, which is the company like mine. We do, you know, EPC stands for engineering, procurement and construction. That's a whole host of possibilities as well, where, you know, young people can choose to take a small element of all the things that are required in putting together a renewable energy system and choose to provide the service or to supply a product. You know, you don't have to do the whole thing. And anyway, for somebody like me, when I develop a project, I purchase all these things. I purchase my inverters, I purchase my solar panels, I purchase my battery systems. Fine, those are generally from larger, you know, companies that are typically multinationals, but I also purchase other things. I purchase little bolts, little nuts. I purchase, you know, cable ties. I purchase people's time and resources. We have to clean these panels as well. That's opportunities around the operations and maintenance. There's opportunities there to maintain these things. You can clean solar panels. You can check up on this. I mean, I've spoken so much about solar PV because that's where I'm from, but there's all sorts of other renewable energy technologies where you can also offer to you know, provide your time in either the operations and maintenance or in the construction thereof. So there's an entire value chain and there's a lot of opportunities. And I think if the youth could just, you know, young people spend a bit of time understanding what it takes to put up these technologies, then there'll be a lot of scope for enterprise.
Great. Thank you so much for that, Marisi. That was quite insightful. We hope that our listeners have learned something new and they've seen the opportunities that exist in the energy space. For our listeners, you can follow our Instagram page, it's the Green Collar Africa. You can follow us on Twitter on Green Sea Africa. Our Facebook is the Africa Green Collar Project, and you can check out our website, greencollarafrica.org. Thank you so much, Marisi. Have a good
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure.